Every day, millions of children go to bed not knowing if they will be the next victims of armed conflict or if they will be forced to fight.
I saw people being whipped. We were told that if you disobeyed, this could happen to you.
In the next hour, we'll visit the battlegrounds and refugee camps that shape the lives of millions of children. We'll hear about child soldiers, children fleeing conflict, and the successful rehabilitation of children touched by war.
You know, the music is something like magic. I don't have time now to talk about the wartime.
And we'll hear how the impact of war lingers long after the shooting stops.
The use of uranium munitions in war is going to cause cancers in the children of Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait.
Stay tuned for a public radio special, Children of War, Fighting, Dying, Surviving. I'm your host, Charlene Hunter-Galt. More after this. For 27 years, rebel fighters in Angola kidnapped thousands of children and forced them to become guerrillas. The civil war ended in 2002, but the legacy of child soldiers continues. Here in Quito, Angola, I met a former child soldier from UNITA, the National Union for the Total Independence of Angola. I also met his brother, who fought on the government side. This is the tale of two brothers, child soldiers, and the country's struggle for reconciliation. For Feliciano Salamungo, it was a day like any other, walking home from school as oblivious to the scorching Angolan sun as he was to the men lurking in its shadows.
Quando vinha.
In the middle of the way, I met a UNITA patrol. I was taken by them.
Feliciano Salamungo was 11 years old.
Yes, I was frightened. I was not expecting anything like that. Suddenly, there were troops asking me to join the group.
Feliciano had no choice but to follow for the next two decades.
We were obliged to walk a long way. We reached unknown areas. We didn't have any idea where we were living. It was living in the middle of the bush, like a strange land.
That got stranger all the time.
You never have a permanent home. You are here today, 2 hours later, you move. Sometimes you have to sleep under trees. Sometimes you have to sleep in rivers, in water.
11 years old and forcibly conscripted into a brutal civil war. Shortly before Angola's independence in 1975, the liberation movements fighting the Portuguese fractured and began to fight each other. The Soviet Union and Cuba backed the government side. The United States and apartheid South Africa armed Jonas Savimbi's UNITA. The war went on. It eventually claimed the lives of more than 1.5 million Angolans. Feliciano had no idea why he was taken or why the guerrillas who took him were fighting.
You had to follow them, do what you were told, otherwise your life could be in danger.
What kind of punishments did he see?
I saw people being whipped, people being sent to distant areas. When there was physical punishment, we were invited to witness. We were told that if you disobeyed, this could happen to you.
UNITA became known for its tactics of kidnapping whole villages and attacking civilian supporters of the government. The United States and apartheid South Africa backed UNITA on the grounds it was fighting Soviet expansion in Africa. Feliciano recalls the support UNITA got from the United States.
Estados Unidos, América.
I was told the relations between the U.S. and the UNITA were very good. This was proven because I myself saw medicine sent from the U.S. I used to distribute some weapons from the U.S. to my fellow soldiers.
The United States stopped supporting UNITA in 1993 when the guerrillas violated an internationally brokered peace plan. But UNITA continued fighting, forcing thousands of children to become soldiers. Many, like Feliciano Salamungo, were forced by circumstances to become men. But the child in Feliciano lay just beneath the surface.
I missed my family.
Did you ever cry?
Yes, several times I cried.
Feliciano belonged to a force supporting the front lines, providing food, clothes, and ammunition. He says he saw many young people like himself forced to kill, but he says he never had to. That was one of the few good things about his time as a guerrilla, for there was a chance the Angolan government soldier on the other side may have been his own brother.
A nítida sensação das coisas libertas.
Jeremias Salamungo had joined the Angolan army before Feliciano was kidnapped. The government didn't abduct children to become soldiers, but teens under 18 fought in the government military, sometimes as volunteers, sometimes as conscripts. Jeremias had no idea his brother had become his enemy. But one day, he got the word.
It was hard, but what could I do? I also was forced to do that. At that time, when you don't identify completely with the side where you are, you can be identified as collaborating with the other side. And this could be very dangerous.
The Salamungo family was touched by the war in many other ways. Their sister was forced to marry an MPLA officer. Once the war ended, she left him. It was different for Feliciano, who married in the bush, a young woman, herself, abducted at the age of 8. She was forced to tend the wounded on the battlefield. Fortunately for the Salamungos, the brothers didn't meet on the battlefield, but in a camp as the armed forces were demobilizing after a peace treaty was finally signed. By chance, Feliciano heard his brother's name called by a colleague. He then asked that he take a letter to the man he thought could be his brother. Jeremias read the letter in disbelief.
I had to control myself.
Within a week, Jeremias was in the camp.
Before 10 minutes, they were coming with somebody who I couldn't recognize. He was short and he was a little bit slim. I recognize this part here, his chin.
As for Feliciano,
all the words disappeared from my mouth. 22 years of separation isn't an easy thing.
Nor is it easy for the former UNITA guerrillas, who did in fact kill, if not their brothers, their own kind, and were killed in return. Reconciliation is a key challenge in this deeply wounded country. The Angolan government is keenly aware of the challenge it faces. João Kusumwa is the Minister of Social Assistance and Reinsertion.
Há crianças pelo menos dos 10 anos até os 20 anos.
Children from 10 to 20 years old were used as soldiers. They didn't study. We have people who pass school age that we must teach to read and write. As you know, the government must solve all the problems, economic and psychological.
And that's the ticking time bomb that makes the peace of Angola so precarious. Finding the resources and the places for the thousands of children and adults whose only skills were those learned on the battlefield. That and helping those like Feliciano's 29-year-old wife, Augusta Chilombo, who gave birth to their 4 daughters virtually on the battlefield. As shy as she is tiny, she rarely speaks above a whisper until I ask her about her dreams for her young daughters. Her voice is filled with commitment and determination.
I'd like to see my daughters have a different life from the one I've had so far. We were suffering because of war. Now that the war has ended, I would like to see my children having a better life. I would like to see them studying so they can live well.
Whatever else Angola's long night of war may have destroyed, it failed to destroy the capacity to dream. It's now up to the people of Angola and countries around the world to help the dreams for their wounded children become reality. I'm Charlene Hunter-Galt in Quito, Angola.
Thank you.
While world attention is focused on child soldiers here in Africa, industrialized countries also recruit teens under 18, a violation of the spirit of international treaties. The United Kingdom allows children as young as 15 3/4 to sign up for the army. And these junior soldiers face myriad problems similar to child soldiers the world over. Correspondent Max Easterman reports.
Two platoons of junior soldiers are being put through their paces in the gym. This is the Army Foundation College outside Harrogate in northern England. Its job is to train well over 1,000 16 and 17-year-old recruits every year. And I'm going to meet a group of them now. They gave up civilian life, what they call Civvy Street, only 14 weeks ago. What attracted you to the army?
The lifestyle. You can go places and you don't have to pay. It's a good life.
Good money. Plenty of money. More than you might in Civvy Street.
You get a military education as well as a civil education. It's better than working at McDonald's or something like all your other mates.
These days, the army can't afford to be too choosy if it's to pull in the 4,000 or so junior soldiers it needs every year. They can sign up as early as 15 3/4, and they then start training on their 16th birthday. 17-year-olds fought in the Falklands War and in Kosovo, but they're no longer deployed on active duty until they're 18. But the army couldn't survive without them, as Major Dicky Hamzat's been telling me. He's the company commander of these recruits.
I think it gets us a better army, without a shadow of a doubt. They can be moulded, even though the decisions I have to make are quite daunting for them initially. We should recruit from this age group, because if we don't start recruiting at this early age, these people will get into long-term relationships, will look at other aspects of their life, they're in a settled job. They won't look to the army for a career, and they'll be lost to us. We must get hold of these young people and recruit them where we can.
The British Army has for years taken advantage of the fact that young, working-class men and women prefer to get a job rather than an education. But the Army's critics say there's little difference in motive between what Britain and some third-world governments do. Recruit teens because they're easier to mould into fighters. The Army rejects that argument, noting that parents must approve their child's decision. As one officer in charge of recruitment put it to me, the 16-year-olds are there, they want to join, and it would be irresponsible to leave them on the streets where they'd just cause trouble. Colonel Mike von Bertele is the Army's head of employment policy, and he says the British Army offers these young people a way out of poverty and social deprivation.
I think it really stems from the switch to being an all-volunteer army and get away from conscription. And so traditionally we have taken a large number of people into the army who are low educational achievers at school, who are effectively thrown out of school at the age of 16 or even 15 with very few employment prospects ahead of them. We know that if we can get them young enough before they settle into low-paid work, for example, that we can do an awful lot with them.
You do seem to be saying, though, that you're, in a sense, picking up the educational dregs. Is that right?
We wouldn't describe them like that, but they are the low achievers. We do take people who either have significant educational or social problems. And it's one of the great things about the army is that it does take those people and does an awful lot with them, gives them an education, gives them a skill, gives them a trade, and gives them a huge sense of self-worth.
Critics say the army promises junior soldiers education and job skills, but often doesn't mention they may have to serve as much as 12 years if they take skills training courses. When the junior soldiers realise this, the consequences can be disastrous, according to Gwyn Gwinterfer, a counsellor with the Soldiers Advice Centre at Ease.
I've had clients who've broken their own right arm. Others have attempted suicide. One quite common thing is when they're on leave, they get hold of drugs. They've planted them in their own bed space. They've then gone out to a phone box and made an anonymous call to the army saying that they've got drugs in the hope that the army will kick them out. A lot of youngsters try to get hold of drugs just before they're having a medical so that it will be detected. And this is quite frightening because where you get very naive teenagers getting hold of dangerous drugs, swallowing them in large quantities just so that they will be detected. It's very, very dangerous.
The crisis some junior soldiers find themselves in has been quite tragically highlighted at one particular barracks in Surrey, Deepcut, near London. While sexual harassment is a problem for many women soldiers, the junior soldiers have been particularly vulnerable at Deep Cut, and no fewer than four juniors have been found shot dead there. The army claims they're all suicides. Their parents don't think so. They attribute the deaths to a culture of bullying by fellow soldiers. Jeff Gray was 17 when he was found dead on guard duty, a week after 9/11. He was shot twice through the head. In spite of that fact, the army still claims it was suicide. His father, also called Jeff, lives here in Hackney, East London. He says his son would never have taken his own life.
We've got a situation where I think Deep Cut is running on a two-tier level. We've got the officers living in the little own world, and then we've got the non-commissioned officers actually running the camp. Some are out of control, and we've got a situation where there's bullying and there's sexual harassment, and it isn't being picked up by commissioned officers. If an officer had told Jeff to do something that wasn't of the norm, he would say something. He would probably say, no, sir, I know I can't do that because of A or because of B. My real worry is that Jeff paid the ultimate price of bullying, that he didn't accept what he was being told to do, and he's paid the price for it.
The parents are demanding a full public inquiry into what happened at Deep Cut Barracks. The army and the government have refused. They have, however, conceded that bullying and sexual harassment are rife in the British Army and have now drawn up an action plan to monitor what NCOs get up to and to stamp these activities out. But the wider point is undeniable. Junior soldiers in Britain face some of the same kinds of problems as child soldiers everywhere. If you give young people guns and live ammunition, sooner or later they use them. I'm Max Easterman in London.
During the Persian Gulf War, the United States and Britain fired 320 tons of depleted uranium ammunition. Critics say that as a result, thousands of Iraqi children got cancer, and many were born with birth defects. The U.S. is expected to use depleted uranium ammunition once again in Iraq. The military says it poses no danger to civilians. Producer Reese Ehrlich visited southern Iraq and former Yugoslavia to find out what impact depleted uranium may have on children of war.
Dr. Assad Issa, chief resident of the Children's and Maternity Hospital in Basra, walks down the corridor to the cancer ward, where a little girl sits with her mother on the floor.
Yeah, what kind of cancer does she have?
She has an abdominal tumor, the neuroblastoma.
Near the kidney.
Oh, okay. A tumor near the kidney.
How old is she?
Eight and a half years.
This little girl lives in an area where depleted uranium ammunition was fired during the Gulf War. The U.S. and Britain use such ammunition because it's heavier and stronger than lead, so it's highly effective slicing through enemy armor. But when the DU hits a hard target, it creates a small radioactive fireball. Pulverized dust can enter the air, soil, and water, and it remains radioactive for billions of years. Iraqi doctors blame many childhood cancers and birth defects on the use of depleted uranium.
There is no changes in Iraq situations and Iraqi conditions except the war. And what happened in the war was that the Iraq bombed by a using of the weapons that's containing depleted uranium. It is one of the major factors for development of malignancies.
Iraqi doctors report a fourfold increase in birth defects since the end of the Gulf War and a similar rise in childhood cancers. Doctors in former Yugoslavia, where the U.S. also used DU, have discovered similar problems. Doctors in Iraq say they don't have the equipment or drugs to properly treat the patients.
Now, in the case of the daughter here, what do you think her prognosis is?
A poor prognosis, because we have no medicine.
She will die.
Yes.
The allegations that this is from the Gulf War do not seem to be credible.
Dr. Michael Kilpatrick is second in command of the Pentagon's department dealing with Gulf War illnesses. He acknowledges serious medical problems exist among Iraqi children, but says DU doesn't harm civilians because the fine dust doesn't disperse very far. Dr. Kilpatrick says the cancers and birth defects may, in fact, have been caused by poison gas used during the Iran-Iraq War.
Some of this population during the Iran-Iraq War was exposed to mustard agent. We know that mustard agent can cause cancers in children born of people who are exposed, that would have to be understood and researched to better understand if that is a possible cause of some of the disease or illness being seen.
But that's not what another military expert says. Major Doug Rocky, now retired, was in charge of cleaning up American tanks hit by DU during the Gulf War, casualties of friendly fire. He says the DU dust got blown far away by the wind and entered the soil and water supply. Dr. Rocky, who holds a PhD in physics, says many of the men in his cleanup crew developed the same kinds of cancers seen among Iraqi children.
The first member of our staff that developed cancer, he was sleeping in the first tent downwind of the site where I collected all of the contaminated equipment. This is in Saudi Arabia. He developed cancer in the larynx and the throat area within 9 months because he was breathing in the dust, which we know goes tremendous distances. And then the first cancers, the lung cancers, developed within 2 years in our staff, and the first deaths were fairly rapidly.
Dr. Rocky says depleted uranium poses a particular danger for children because their young bodies are more vulnerable. DU is both radioactive and a toxic heavy metal. Children who breathe or even eat a small amount can be affected. He says if the U.S. uses depleted uranium in Iraq again, it may well cause serious health problems in years to come.
In no circumstances should the citizens of the world allow the use of uranium munitions. The use of uranium munitions in war is going to cause cancers, respiratory, eye problems, neurological problems in the children of Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait.
While something is terribly wrong with the children of southern Iraq, no one has conducted a thorough epidemiological study that links the problems directly to DU. Even critics of U.S. policy concede that the use of poison gas or heavy air pollution could also be causing health problems. That's why developments in former Yugoslavia are so intriguing. The U.S. also used DU ammunition in the Bosnia and Kosovo wars. Pediatricians in Sarajevo now report a five-fold increase in childhood leukemia. Dr. Nada Setzmil-Saric is a medical oncologist who treats Bosnian families who live near a bridge hit by DU ammunition in 1994.
This bridge has been completely destroyed since the war in Bosnia and Herzegovina. 8 years after this, we observed some families who live just near, quite close to this bridge. The increase in leukemias in childhood really exists.
Dr. Setzmil-Saric also reports a 5 to 6-fold increase in breast cancer, which is not known to be caused by DU. So, as in Iraq, there may be a number of other factors at work. But the governments of Serbia and Montenegro aren't waiting for the conclusive scientific proof. They're taking steps now to clean up the depleted uranium and protect their children. Here in Cape Arza, a spectacularly beautiful area just south of Dubrovnik along the Adriatic coast, U.S. planes fired DU ammunition in the closing days of the Kosovo War. The DU remains buried in the soil. Physicist Tomislav Andelic is in charge of removing the DU, along with all the contaminated soil. Men with chainsaws cut down the trees and brush. Andelic runs a Geiger counter over the ground until he finds a bullet fragment.
Now it means that we found the bullet.
This is one larger fragment. Here, you can see that he is destroyed. When he hit the stone, he broke itself. But if you see, there is a lot of little particles oxidizing, which is real, real danger.
The DU is dangerous because as it decomposes, the dust can fly into the air or seep into the water table. Children handling the fragments on the surface could face serious health problems, says Dr. Andelic, now speaking in Serbo-Croatian.
Somebody may come in the future, spread a tent, and endanger his life if the area is not cleaned up. There's also the possibility that children, out of curiosity, could find a uranium bullet and take it into their hands. Then we would face a big problem.
The Serbian government also plans to clean up 5 sites on its territory where DU was used during the Kosovo War, at a cost of about $400,000 for each site. Dr. Andelic, entering a shed where the DU fragments are stored, says no one in the international community will help.
If
any country or any organization recognized the need for cleaning up depleted uranium, it would automatically mean that they recognize the danger coming from using DU. If this happened, we could seek damages in court, and nobody is ready to accept that.
While the Pentagon continues to insist that DU poses no danger to children and other civilians, the Marines and Navy say they have replaced DU with other kinds of ammo, and the Air Force plans to do the same. That could help the children of future wars, but it is of little solace to those in Iraq and former Yugoslavia. I'm Reese Ehrlich in Cape Arza, Montenegro.
You're listening to Children of War, Fighting, Dying, Surviving, a one-hour public radio special. For more information, visit our website at warchildren.org. Coming up, programs that help heal children's bodies, minds, and spirits. And do all those international agreements protecting children do any good? I'm your host, Charlene Hunter-Galt. More after this. Displacement is a universal symptom of war. Here in Africa, fighting has forced more than 4 million people from their homes. More than 1 million people fled the 1999 war in Kosovo. In almost every case, half of these refugees are children. As correspondent Keith Porter discovered, for children, fleeing war can be as dangerous as war itself.
War is hell. For children, running from a war can be even worse.
We were running toward the border. A Serbian policeman stopped us.
In 1999, Igbala Paciorici, an ethnic Albanian, grabbed her son and daughter and fled the war in Kosovo.
First, they burned my daughter's face. She started crying, "Mother!" I just told her, "Keep silent, keep silent." Her face was covered with blood. They hit my son in the stomach and he fell to the ground. I was just saying, "Oh my God." Then they said, "Take the children, start walking, don't look back." So we walked. I was expecting, bam, bam, that they would kill the kids and me. But with God's grace, we were saved.
Many families like these flee the horrors of war only to end up in refugee camps. Even the best of these camps offer cold comfort to children in crisis situations.
A refugee camp can be a very dangerous place. You're putting an enormous number of people in very close proximity, and these are people who are tired, who have often become ill. You know, there are all sorts of health risks in a refugee camp situation.
Patrick Fruchet has worked for UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, in a number of conflict zones, most recently Kosovo, where thousands of children displaced by the 1999 war still suffer in camps like this one, called Plementina, just outside of Pristina. Many of these children, especially Serbs and Roma, also known as Gypsies, are afraid to leave because they fear ethnic attacks. Anver Krasnici is the American Refugee Committee field agent in charge of this camp.
I will tell you then, for children it's a difficult life here in the camp because only some people of the camp, they are free to move because some of them they are scared to go like outside to Obilić or Pristina or something. But for children it's a very difficult life.
How old are you? Do you speak English?
No
English, no.
Hello.
As we walk through the camp, the ground is wet and there's some mud. And lots of clothes being hung out to dry. What's his name?
Kenan.
Kenan. Kenan, how old are you?
Josh.
Six.
6 years old. How long have you lived here in Plementina?
God.
Full 3 years.
For 3 years. How is your life here?
It's very difficult.
Very difficult. Do you want to go somewhere else?
Yes, I do.
Yes. Where would you like to go?
In Austria.
In Austria.
Sandra, who helped translate, works for the United Nations at the Plementina camp.
What's life like for a child in Plementina camp?
It's quite difficult. The fact that they live somewhere else instead of their home, it's horrible enough. As much as we can, we are trying to give them a decent way of life, but sometimes it's very difficult.
She is concerned that the scars of war and the trauma of fleeing war will never heal for these children, causing long-term problems for them and the rest of the world.
You should see some pictures that they are making, even for the people who doesn't have anything to do with the psychosocial program, they can realize that there are some scars.
Beyond the psychological trauma, children on the run from war face threats to their personal security, suffer from a lack of regular education, and little or no health care. Again, Patrick Fruché from UNICEF.
A child is more likely to die from not being immunized as a result of armed conflict than to die as a result of the armed conflict. In other words, it's the same thing. I mean, that because of the disruption of the conflict, they don't receive their immunization, and therefore they're vulnerable to a whole slew of child killers, basically.
What can be done to help these children? I asked Sandra if there are lessons here that can be applied in other conflicts.
Let's try not to have a conflict first. Let's be more focused on the kids. They are our future, and if they have scars from the conflicts, one day they will be a person with scars, and they can become violent. You can see many of the kids are violent, without reason.
You think it might be the seeds for another war?
Yes, unfortunately, yes. They've suffered because of the war, and those scars can make from them, unfortunately, another warriors. What we do not want. Let's have more doctors and more teachers.
Sandra and others say listening to voices from the field is vital because it reminds aid providers that each conflict situation is different and humanitarian responses must be tailored to fit local needs.
It has to be much more, let's say, targeted. It would be better if the donors comes down to the field. Please do not stay at the headquarters. I know that you like your offices with air conditioners and these things. If you want to have like improved humanitarian assistance situation in Kosovo, please come down to the field.
A 1951 United Nations convention guarantees refugees the right to return to their homes, but that's not as easy as it sounds, particularly in Kosovo, where the ethnic Albanian government has not welcomed the return of minority Serbs and Roma. Patrick Fruché says UNICEF is working in one particular Kosovo community to help families return, but the results are frustrating.
There were basically a number of men whose wives and children were not there. And we spoke to them about, will your family come? You're rebuilding your home. Will your family come? And the answer was, well, not unless there's health care and education. And so for UNICEF, the right to return, it's not just to return to a house. It's to return to a community with services.
It is very unlikely or unreasonable to expect that 3 years after what happened here that, you know, all of a sudden these people are going to be welcomed back with open arms by the majority community.
Simon Haselock is chief spokesperson for the United Nations mission which runs Kosovo. He says the UN plans for returning refugees and displaced people to their homes are based on creating both safe conditions and local services. And he knows that for children and adults, this is an urgent task.
The next 2 or 3 years are the critical years for returns. If it lasts any longer than that, of course, you then become into the problem where these people become too embedded where they are, and it's less likely that they will return at all.
That's a sobering thought and a vivid reminder that child refugees can be just as much victims as those injured in war, and it's up to their parents to resolve the underlying problems that led to war in the first place. I'm Keith Porter, Pristina, Kosovo.
Even when war ends, children are still in danger. Aid agencies must find creative ways to provide education, health care, and psychological development. Correspondent Kristen McHugh profiles three small but successful programs designed to help heal the mind, body, and spirit of war's youngest victims.
I went through the Second World War as a Jewish child, so being aware what does mean to a child being in a war and persecuted.
Psychiatrist Anitza Kos knows the dangers of war firsthand. She now draws on her own childhood experiences to help children of modern-day conflicts pick up the pieces of their shattered lives.
There are adversities to which children are exposed.
The list of adversities is long. Interrupted education, lack of quality health care, and the loss of social interaction, just to name a few. In many cases, the consequences appear well after the conflict ends. Here in Cambodia, the physical consequences are unavoidable. The country is struggling to emerge from 3 decades of civil war. In 1999, the World Bank estimated nearly 10% of Cambodia's population was disabled. Children account for nearly 20% of that disabled population. But experts say poor infrastructure makes the actual number of disabled citizens difficult to track. A countless number of the disabled end up begging for food and money at locations popular with foreigners, like here at Phnom Penh's Central Market. But help is available. Children and adults from all across the country travel to the King Klang Rehabilitation Center near Phnom Penh for free treatment and care.
First, we start with the screening.
Hing Chenarith manages the King Klang Physical Rehabilitation Center for Veterans International, a program of the Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation. Founded in 1991, King Klang has grown into a multi-service facility for amputees, landmine victims, and persons with a host of other physical disabilities, including polio. Each month, more than 250 patients pass through King Klang. Roughly half are children. Today, new patient Song Chok Chen quietly answers questions about his health. Polio has crippled one of the 14-year-old's legs. Cambodia's polio epidemic stems directly from the country's war-torn history. Song Chok Chen now sits alone with a physical therapist in King Klang's large rehabilitation room. He looks terrified, but puts on a brave face.
My parents are in a suburb in Phnom Penh. I got a neighbor who brought me here. I'm not scared.
We're no longer seeing children coming to us under the age of, say, 3 with polio, but over the age of 3 all the way up to adults, the number of polio victims in this country is phenomenal, so we get lots and lots of people with polio.
Larry Warren is the country director for Veterans International's Cambodia Rehabilitation Program.
Polio victims are victims of war because of the level of health and nutrition in this country, and more particularly because of the fact that it was impossible to have any type of a thorough eradication campaign in Cambodia up until the last few years.
Some of the patients end up in wheelchairs. Others are fitted with braces or artificial limbs. All are manufactured to specifications on site. Larry Warren says this comprehensive approach is the key to King Klang's success. King Klang's wide range of treatment may not be obvious to these young patients as they play an enthusiastic game of wheelchair basketball, but it is obvious that the care these children receive here allows them to experience the joys of youth instead of watching from the sidelines. Mending the physical scars of child war victims is crucial, but so is teaching them new positive ways to interact.
You can reach children in primary schools, and those children, if they are helped and empowered, very often they become literally therapists for their family members.
Child psychiatrist Anita Kos.
This is very, very important, because when the war happened to you, you feel as a victim, and as a victim you are very prone to feel helpless. But if you can control a part of your life, for instance, the school life, then it means that you have some power, and it is improving the coping capacities of children.
Here in Macedonia, the United Nations Children's Fund, or UNICEF, hopes tolerance will spread the seeds of peace. Macedonia's transition from Yugoslav Republic to nationhood was relatively peaceful, but tensions between Macedonians and ethnic Albanians erupted into a full-scale conflict here in 2001. NATO helped broker a peace accord, but divisions still linger. Macedonian schools remain, for the most part, segregated. Ethnic Albanian and Macedonian students may attend the same school, but they study in separate classrooms. Yet here at a primary school in the capital Skopje, ethnic Albanian and Macedonian students have come together in the same classroom. This after-school activity is part of UNICEF's local peace education program. Today's lesson, Same, Alike, Different, explores the similarities and differences of the two ethnic groups. UNICEF Project Officer Elena Misik.
It is very, very possible, almost certain, that these children who learn in Macedonian and in Albanian separate classes would never spend any time in a classroom together, let alone speaking and doing activities jointly. The activity deals with self-expression, with expression of one's own desires and wishes, and also with the awareness that we are all unique human beings.
UNICEF's peace education program is currently operating in 7 schools throughout Macedonia. And if the excitement of this particular class is any indication, school-based tolerance programs could be successful tools in the slow and difficult task of rebuilding any nation torn apart by war.
If you go through war, you encounter so many bad things that really your vision of the humanity is destroyed somehow. You see everything only as bad.
Again, child psychiatrist Anitza Kos.
Therefore, it is so important to provide to children some proofs that good still exists in this world. I think this is really the most important, much more important than all psychologists and psychiatrists.
These children in Jacova, Kosovo have seen both the best and worst humanity has to offer. They live in Slovene Village, a transit shelter camp on the outskirts of town. All lost a family member during Slobodan Milosevic's ethnic cleansing drive and the subsequent NATO bombing campaign that ended the Kosovo War of 1999. Once a week, these children gather in their camp's cold and decaying recreation center to forget the horrors of war. The children are participants in the Shropshire Music Foundation's Singing and Harmonica program. Founded in 1999 by Los Angeles composer and music teacher Liz Shropshire, the program uses music to teach children valuable skills in a non-threatening environment.
We're not just teaching kids how to sing some songs. We're teaching them how to read rhythms, how to read notes.
You know, the music is something like magic. They didn't have this activity before.
21-year-old volunteer Boyram Vernici, a Shropshire graduate, leads the weekly Slovene Village harmonica class.
Now they are talking about the music. They don't have time now to talk about the war times.
More than 4,000 children in the Jacova area have benefited from the Shropshire Music Foundation's therapy programs since 1999.
Music is amazing. Music goes all the way down in your soul. And when you're really making music, you're really singing with all your heart, or you're really playing an instrument, everything that you have in you is giving to that. And that's why this program could work here. Unfortunately, there's so many places in our world that need programs like this.
The Shropshire Music Foundation, UNICEF's Peace Education Program in Macedonia, and the Veterans International King Klang Physical Rehabilitation Center in Cambodia are only 3 examples of the thousands of conflict and post-conflict aid programs for children around the globe. And although each one works in a different cultural and political environment, all 3 operate with the simple goal of empowering children. Child psychiatrist Anitza Kos says this empowerment is the key to recovery.
It's very important to involve them in activities, but just bringing children to do something together, not just to talk about reconciliation, but somehow to experience that the person from the other side can be trusted.
I'm Kristen McHugh, Jacova, Kosovo.
Over the last decade, the United Nations has passed major agreements protecting the rights of children and banning child soldiers. But what do they mean in practice? And what role does the United States play in this all-important area? To find out, I talked with high-ranking officials and ordinary people receiving aid in Angola. First stop, Julia Friedson, coordinator of the Watch List on Children and Armed Conflict, a network of non-governmental organizations. She says the UN has made tremendous progress in raising awareness about issues affecting children of war, but there's a gap between what's written on paper and what happens in the field.
The reality is that when you're talking about international policy and you're talking about the UN Security Council and other big international bodies, the wheels of change are too slow for many of these kids. By the time we're done talking about what we should be doing to protect the kids, many of them have already lost their lives or suffered in other horrible ways.
Take, for example, the issue of landmines. More than 130 countries have ratified a treaty banning the use of mines. Joe Becker with the Children's Rights Division of Human Rights Watch says landmines can have a particularly devastating effect on children.
When children step on landmines, they're much more likely to be killed than adults because of their smaller body size and their vulnerability to the kinds of injuries that landmines cause.
Becker says that since 1997, when the treaty took effect, the use of landmines has declined around the world. But some countries, including the United States, have not signed the treaty, arguing that they mark minefields and therefore their explosives aren't a danger to civilians. But that's not how it looks to the victims. In Macedonia, once part of Yugoslavia, we met 200 first-grade children watching a play where animal characters discover an unexploded bomb. These children live in Tatovo, a site of heavy fighting between ethnic Albanians and Macedonians during the Balkans conflict. In this region, landmines planted by both sides, as well as unexploded cluster bombs dropped by Holland, Britain, and the United States, still pose grave dangers to civilians. Cluster bombs are made up of many small bomblets contained within one large delivery system. Experts estimate that between 7 and 11% of the bomblets do not explode on impact. Cluster bombs are not covered by the landmine treaty, but do pose a danger to children. Education efforts like this play, put on by the International Committee of the Red Cross, are helping children understand the importance of not picking them up.
Don't go near, don't touch, don't throw anything at it, and come and tell me right away.
The message is not to touch unknown objects. Tell our parents if there is danger, and don't even get close to unknown objects.
While some countries have not signed the landmine treaty, every country in the United Nations has ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child, except Somalia and the United States. The treaty guarantees children's rights to education, housing, and a decent standard of living. The United States Senate has refused to ratify the treaty because it bans the death penalty for anyone under 18 and allegedly takes rights away from parents. Ambassador Michael Southwick, a State Department Deputy Secretary, says the convention interferes with how countries treat children within their own borders.
Some countries try to give it the status of a secular religion and say this is the only standard in the world. To me, this is an absolutely silly position. How people treat children in the world is a product of culture, it's a product of religious traditions and so forth, and to say that one treaty negotiated at one particular time is the be-all and end-all on children is a little bit absurd.
But human rights activist Joe Becker says failure to ratify the convention damages U.S. credibility around the world.
When I travel outside of the United States, I'm repeatedly asked by both government officials as well as people from civil society why the U.S., which purports to be a champion for children, has not ratified the most basic convention designed to protect them.
The United States has also angered human rights groups by opposing the International Criminal Court, which, among other duties, will prosecute individuals committing war crimes against children. But those same groups concede America has made progress on other fronts. In 2002, the U.S. ratified the optional protocol banning child soldiers. The State Department's Southwick says U.S. ratification of this treaty is significant.
First and foremost, it breaks a cycle which we have seen over the last few years of the United States being outside some fundamental treaties, or what treaties which are regarded as fundamental by a number of countries, on human rights issues.
Southwick says the U.S. also helps children of war by funding agencies that provide emergency relief to parents and children during and after conflicts. We visited a feeding center run by the World Food Program in Quito, Angola. After 27 years of vicious civil war, the government and rebels agreed to settle their conflict in 2002. But as recently as July of that year, some 45% of children were chronically malnourished. Today, the situation has improved somewhat. Adelia Kakasava is receiving cornmeal, beans, and cooking oil from the World Food Program.
Her baby is moderately malnourished. She thinks that this food will help her to recover from malnourished.
How old is the baby?
O bebê tem quantos anos?
Tem 1 ano.
1 year.
5 children. And this is the only one who's sick?
É só este que está doente?
Sim.
Yes.
Angola still could face serious food shortages because landmines and war-damaged roads make it difficult to reach the former child soldiers and other civilians in remote areas. Sadaka Ogata, a former UN High Commissioner for Refugees, worries that children in countries such as Angola suffer when world attention shifts to new crises, like a war in Iraq.
When there is not the really big outflow of people, a refugee crisis, the international attention seems to fade away a bit. And the money doesn't come. People don't have the resources to be present in unstable areas. In Africa, I think there's a double problem of not only security problems, but also poverty problems.
Certainly, children wouldn't suffer if their parents didn't wage war. And every country agrees that, at least in theory, nations must not conduct war against civilians. But has this international attention helped promote those concepts in practice? Olara Otunu is the UN Special Representative for Children in Armed Conflict. He told me in an interview that ratifying international treaties has been a major and necessary step forward. Now, the UN must apply these international norms to individual countries.
We must translate these norms into a protective regime on the ground that can save a child in danger in situations of conflict. That we must now move to begin systematically monitoring and reporting, naming and shaming parties in conflict that continue to abuse children and mobilize international pressure to lean on them to change their practices.
Otunu says he's also worried that some nations continue to ignore international laws protecting children. Whether they are third world dictatorships or industrialized democracies, Otunu offers this appeal.
No matter what quarrels we have among ourselves, children have not contributed to that. And so I would hope we could agree that all our children are entitled to special attention and protection. And that we should create a world, especially the world of the 21st century, in which all these children can be safe and protected.
That's a beautiful dream and a daunting challenge. This story was produced by Matt McCleskey. I'm Charlene Hunter-Galt. Children of War, Fighting, Dying, Surviving was produced by Reese Ehrlich in association with KQED Public Radio. The show was made possible by the Stanley Foundation, producer of Common Ground, radio's weekly program on world affairs. The sound engineer is Rima Snyder of Red Wagon Audio. Cliff Brockman provided production assistance. We want to thank producer Matt McCleskey, the UN's International Broadcast Center, and the staff of Feature Story News. For more information about Children of War, or to share your thoughts about this program, visit our website at warchildren.org. You've been listening to a public radio special, Children of War, Fighting, Dying, Surviving. I'm your host, Charlene Hunter-Galt.